Chapter 7. Ancient Marvels, or Space Travel Centers. To the north of Damascus lies the Terrace of Baalbek, a platform built of stone blocks, some of which have sides more than 65 feet long and weigh nearly 2,000 tons. Until now, archaeologists have not been able to give a convincing explanation why, how, and by whom the Terrace of Baalbek was built. However, Russian Professor Agrest considers it possible that the terrace is the remains of a gigantic airfield. If we meekly accept the neat package of knowledge that the Egyptologists serve up to us, ancient Egypt appears suddenly and without transition with a fantastic ready-made civilization. Great cities and enormous temples, colossal statues with tremendous expressive power, splendid streets flanked by magnificent sculptures, perfect drainage systems, luxurious tombs carved out of the rock, pyramids of overwhelming size, these and many other wonderful things shot out of the ground, so to speak. Genuine miracles in a country that is suddenly capable of such achievements without recognizable prehistory. Fertile agricultural land exists only in the Nile Delta and on small strips to the left and right of the river. Yet experts now estimate the number of inhabitants at the time of the building of the Great Pyramid at 50 million. A figure, incidentally, that flagrantly contradicts the 20 million considered to be the total population of the world in 3000 BC. With such enormous estimates, a couple of million men, more or less, does not matter. But one thing is clear. They all had to be fed. There was not only a host of construction workers, stonemasons, engineers, and sailors. There were not only hundreds of thousands of slaves, but also a well-equipped army, a large and pampered priesthood, countless merchants, farmers, and officials, and last but not least, the Pharaonic household living on the fat of the land. Could they all have lived on the scanty yields of agriculture in the Nile Delta? I shall be told that the stone blocks used for building the temple were moved on rollers. In other words, wooden rollers. But the Egyptians could scarcely have felled and turned into rollers the few trees, mainly palms, that then, as now, grew in Egypt, because the dates from the palms were urgently needed for food, and the trunks and fronds were the only things giving shade to the dried-up ground. But they must have been wooden rollers, otherwise there would not be even the feeblest technical explanation of the building of the pyramids. Did the Egyptians import wood? In order to import wood, there must have been a sizable fleet, and even after it had been landed in Alexandria, the wood would have had to be transported up the Nile to Cairo. Since the Egyptians did not have horses and carts at the time of the building of the Great Pyramid, there was no other possibility. The horse and cart was not introduced until the 17th dynasty, about 1600 BC. My kingdom for a convincing explanation of the transport of the stone blocks. Of course, the scholars say that wooden rollers were needed. There are many problems connected with the technology of the pyramid builders, and no genuine solutions. How did the Egyptians carve tombs out of the rock? What resources did they have in order to lay out a maze of galleries and rooms? The walls are smooth and mostly decorated with paintings in relief. The shafts slope down into the rocky soil. They have steps built in the best tradition of craftsmanship that lead to the burial chambers far below. Hordes of tourists stand gaping in amazement at them, but none of them gets an explanation of the mysterious technique used in their excavation. Yet it is firmly established that the Egyptians were masters of the art of tunneling from the earliest times, for the old rock-cut tombs are worked in exactly the same way as the more recent ones. There is no difference between the tomb of Teti from the 6th dynasty and the tomb of Ramses I from the New Kingdom, although there is a minimum of 1,000 years between the building of the two tombs. Obviously, the Egyptians had not learned anything new to add to their old technique. In fact, the more recent edifices tend increasingly to be poor copies of their ancient models. The tourist, who bumps his way to the Pyramid of Cheops to the west of Cairo on a camel called Wellington or Napoleon, depending on his nationality, gets the strange sensation in the pit of his stomach that relics of the mysterious past always produce. The guide tells him that a pharaoh had a burial place built here, and with that bit of rehashed erudition he rides homeward, after taking some impressive photographs. The Pyramid of Cheops, in particular, has inspired hundreds of crazy and untenable theories. In the 600-page book, Our Inheritance in the Great Pyramid, by Charles Piazzi Smith, published in 1864, we can read about many hair-raising links between the pyramid and our globe. Yet even after a highly critical examination, it still contains some facts that should stimulate us to reflection. It is well known that the ancient Egyptians practiced a solar religion. Their sun god, Ra, traveled through the heavens in a bark. Pyramid texts of the Old Kingdom even describe heavenly journeys by the king, obviously made with the help of the gods and their boats. So the gods and kings of the Egyptians were also involved with flying. Is it really a coincidence that the height of the Pyramid of Cheops, multiplied by 1,000,000,000, 98 million miles, corresponds approximately to the distance between the Earth and Sun? Is it a coincidence that a meridian running through the pyramids divides continents and oceans into two exactly equal halves? Is it coincidence that the area of the base of the pyramid divided by twice its height gives the celebrated figure pi equals 3.14159? Is it coincidence that calculations of the weight of the Earth were found? And is it also coincidence that the rocky ground on which the structure stands is carefully and accurately leveled? There is not a single clue to explain why the builder of the Pyramid of Cheops, the Pharaoh Khufu, chose that particular rocky terrain in the desert as the site for his edifice. It is conceivable that there was a natural cleft in the rock which he made use of for the colossal building, while another explanation, though only a feeble one, may be that he wanted to watch the progress of the work from his summer palace. Both reasons are against all common sense. In the first case, it would certainly have been more practical to locate the building site nearer the eastern quarries in order to shorten transport distances. And second, it is hard to imagine that the pharaoh wanted to be disturbed year after year by the din that filled building sites day and night, even in those days. Since there is so much to be said against the textbook explanations of the choice of site, one might reasonably ask whether the gods did not have their say here too, even if it was by way of the priesthood. But if that explanation is accepted, there is one more important proof of my theory of the utopian past of mankind. For the pyramid not only divides continents and oceans into two equal halves, it also lies at the center of gravity of the continents. If the facts noted here are not coincidences, and it seems extremely difficult to believe that they are, then the building site was chosen by beings who knew all about the spherical shape of the Earth and the distribution of continents and seas. In this connection, let us not forget Piri Reis's maps. It cannot all be coincidence, or be explained away as fairy stories. With what power, with what machines, with what technical resources was the rocky terrain leveled at all? How did the master builders drive the tunnels downward? And how did they illuminate them? Neither here nor in the rock-cut tombs in the Valley of Kings were torches or anything similar used. There are no blackened ceilings or walls or even the slightest evidence that traces of blackening have been removed. How and with what were the stone blocks cut out of the quarries? With sharp edges and smooth sides? How were they transported and joined together to the thousandth of an inch? Once again, there is a wealth of explanations for anyone to choose from. Inclined planes and tracks along which the stones were pushed, scaffolding and ramps, and naturally the labor of many hundreds of thousands of Egyptian slaves, fellahin, builders and craftsmen. None of these explanations stands up to a critical examination. The Great Pyramid is and remains visible testimony of a technique that has never been understood. Today in the 20th century, no architect could build a copy of the Pyramid of Cheops, even if the technical resources of every continent were at his disposal. 2,600,000 gigantic blocks were cut out of the quarries, dressed and transported, and fitted together on the building site to the nearest thousandth of an inch. And deep down inside in the galleries, the walls were painted in colors. The site of the pyramid was a whim of the pharaoh. The unparalleled classical dimensions of the pyramid occurred to the master builder by chance. Several hundred thousand workers pushed and pulled blocks weighing 12 tons up a ramp with non-existent ropes on non-existent rollers. This host of workers lived on non-existent grain. They slept in non-existent huts, which the pharaoh had built outside his summer palace. the workers were urged on by an encouraging heave-ho over a non-existent loudspeaker, and so the 12-ton blocks were pushed skyward. If the industrious workers had achieved the extraordinary daily piece rate of 10 blocks piled on top of each other, they would have assembled the 2,600,000 stone blocks into the magnificent stone pyramid in about 250,000 days. 664 years. Yes, and don't forget that the whole thing came into being at the whim of an eccentric king who never lived to see the completion of the edifice he had inspired. Of course, one must not even suggest that this theory, so seriously advanced, is ridiculous. Yet who is so ingenious as to believe that the pyramid was nothing but the tomb of a king? From now on, who will consider the transmission of mathematical and astronomical signs as pure chance? Today, the Great Pyramid is undisputedly attributed to the Pharaoh Khufu as inspirer and builder. Why? Because all the inscriptions and tablets refer to Khufu. It seems obvious to me that the pyramid cannot have been erected during a single lifetime. But what if Khufu forged the inscriptions and tablets that are supposed to proclaim his fame? That was quite a popular procedure in antiquity, as many buildings bear witness. Whenever a dictatorial ruler wanted the fame for himself alone, he gave orders for this process to be carried out. If that was the case, then the pyramid existed long before Khufu left his visiting card. In the Bodleian Library at Oxford, there is a manuscript in which the Coptic author Mas'udi asserts that the Egyptian king Surid had the Great Pyramid built. Oddly enough, this Surid ruled in Egypt before the flood. And this wise King Surid ordered his priests to write down the sum total of their wisdom and conceal the writings inside the pyramid. So, according to the Coptic tradition, the pyramid was built before the flood. Herodotus confirms such a supposition in Book 2 of his history. The priests of Thebes had shown him 341 colossal statues, each of which stood for a high priestly generation over a period of 11,340 years. Now, we know that every high priest had his statue made during his own lifetime, and Herodotus also tells us that during his stay in Thebes, one priest after another showed him his statue as a proof that the son had always followed the father. The priests assured Herodotus that their statements were very accurate because they had written everything down for many generations, and they explained that every one of these 341 statues represented a generation. Before these 341 generations, the gods had lived among men, and since then, no god had visited them again in human form. The historical period of Egypt is usually estimated at about 6,500 years. Then why did the priests lie so shamelessly to the traveler Herodotus about their 11,340 years? And why did they so expressly emphasize that no gods had dwelt among them for 341 generations? These precise details would have been completely pointless if gods had not really lived among men in the remote past. We know next to nothing about the how, why, and when of the building of the pyramid. An artificial mountain, some 490 feet high and weighing 6,500,000 tons, stands there as evidence of an incredible achievement, and this monument is supposed to be nothing more than the burial place of an extravagant king. Anyone who can believe that explanation is welcome to it. Mummies, equally incomprehensible and not yet convincingly explained, stare at us from the remote past as if they held some magic secret. Various peoples knew the technique of embalming corpses, and archaeological finds favor the supposition that prehistoric beings believed in corporeal return to a second life. That interpretation would be acceptable if there was even the remotest evidence of a belief in a corporeal return in the religious philosophy of antiquity. If our primitive ancestors had believed in only a spiritual return, they would scarcely have gone to such trouble with the dead. But finds in Egyptian tombs provide example after example of the preparation of embalmed corpses for a corporeal return. What the evidence says, what visible proof says, cannot be so absurd. Drawings and sagas actually indicated that the gods promised to return from the stars in order to awaken the well-preserved bodies to new life. That is why the provisioning of the embalmed corpses in the burial chambers took such a practical form and was intended for a life on this side of the grave. Otherwise, What were they supposed to have done with money, jewelry, and their favorite articles? And as they were even provided in the tomb with some of their servants, who were unquestionably buried alive, the point of all the preparations was obviously the continuation of the old life in a new life. The tombs were tremendously durable and solid, almost atom bomb proof. They could survive the ravages of all the ages. The valuables left in them, gold and precious stones, were virtually indestructible. I am not concerned here with discussing the later abuses of mummification. I am only concerned with the question, who put the idea of corporeal rebirth into the heads of the heathens? And whence came the first audacious idea that the cells of the body had to be preserved so that the corpse, preserved in a very secure place, could be awakened to new life after thousands of years? So far, this mysterious reawakening complex has only been considered from the religious point of view. But supposing the pharaoh, who certainly knew more about the nature and customs of the gods than his subjects, had these possibly quite crazy ideas. I must make a burial place for myself that cannot be destroyed for millennia and is visible far across the country. The gods promise to return and wake me up, or doctors in the distant future will discover a way to restore me to life again. What have we to say about that in the space age? In his book, The Prospect of Immortality, published in 1965, physician and astronomer Robert C.W. Ettinger suggests a way in which 20th century men can have ourselves frozen so that our cells can go on living from the medical and biological point of view, but slowed down a billionfold. For the present, this idea may still sound utopian, but in fact, every big clinic today has a bone bank which preserves human bones in a deep frozen condition for years and makes them serviceable again when required. Fresh blood, this too is a universal practice, can be kept for an unlimited time at minus 196 degrees centigrade, and living cells can be stored almost indefinitely at the temperature of liquid nitrogen. Did the pharaoh have a fantastic idea which will soon be realized in practice? You must listen to what follows twice to grasp the fantastic implications of the result of the next piece of scientific research. In March 1963, biologists of the University of Oklahoma confirmed that the skin cells of the Egyptian Princess Mene were capable of living. And Princess Mene has been dead for several thousand years. There have been finds in many places of mummies which are preserved so completely and intact that they seem to be alive. Glacier mummies left by the Incas survived the ages and theoretically they are capable of living. Utopia? In the summer of 1965, Russian television showed two dogs which had been deep frozen for a week. On the seventh day, they were thawed out again and, hey presto, they went on living as cheerfully as ever. Americans, and this is no secret, are seriously concerned as part of their space program with the problem of how to freeze astronauts of the future for their long journey to distant stars. Dr. Ettinger, often scoffed at today, prophesies a remote future in which men will not be consumed by fire or eaten by worms, a future in which bodies, frozen in deep-freeze cemeteries or deep-freeze bunkers, await the day when advances in medical science can remove the cause of their death and bring their bodies to new life. One can see the terrifying vision of an army of deep-frozen soldiers who will be thawed out as necessary in case of war. A really horrifying idea. But what connection have mummies with our theory of space travelers in the remote past? Am I dragging proofs in willy-nilly? I ask, how did the ancients know that the body cells continue to live, slowed down a billionfold after special treatment? I ask, where did the idea of immortality come from? And how did people get the concept of corporeal reawakening in the first place? The majority of ancient peoples knew the technique of mummification, and the rich people actually practiced it. I am not concerned here with this demonstrable fact, but with solving the problem of where the idea of a reawakening, a return to life, originated. Did the idea occur to some king or tribal prince purely by chance? Or did some prosperous citizen watch gods treating their corpses with a complicated process and preserving them in bomb-proof sarcophagi? Or did some gods, space travelers, transmit to a quick-witted prince of royal blood their knowledge of how corpses can be reawakened after a special treatment. These speculations require confirmation from contemporary sources. In a few hundred years, mankind will have a mastery of space travel that is inconceivable today. Travel agencies will offer trips to the planets with precise departure and return dates in their brochures. Obviously, a prerequisite for this mastery is that all branches of science keep pace with the development of space travel. Electronics and cybernetics alone will not do the trick. Medicine and biology will make their contribution by finding out ways of lengthening the vital functions of human beings. Today, this Department of Space Research is also working in top gear. Here we must ask ourselves, did space travelers in prehistory already possess knowledge that we must gain anew? Did unknown intelligences already know the methods with which to treat bodies so that they could be revived in so many thousand years? Perhaps the gods, being shrewd, had an interest in preserving at least one dead man with all the knowledge of his time, so that some day he could be questioned about the history of his generation. Who can tell? Is it not possible that such an interrogation by gods who came back has already taken place? In the course of the centuries, mummification, originally a solemn matter, became the fashion. Suddenly everyone wanted to be reawakened. Suddenly everyone thought that he would come to a new life so long as he did the same as his forefathers. The high priests, who actually did possess some knowledge of such reawakenings, did a great deal to encourage this cult, for their class did good business out of it. I have already mentioned the physically impossible ages of the Sumerian kings and the biblical figures. I asked whether these people could not have been space travelers who prolonged their lifespan through the effect of the time shift on interstellar flights just below the speed of light. Are we perhaps getting a clue into the incredible age of the men named in the texts if we assume that they were mummified or frozen? If we follow this theory, then the unknown space travelers would have frozen leading personalities in antiquity, put them into an artificial deep sleep, as legends tell us, and taken them out of the drawer, thawed them out, and conversed with them during subsequent visits. At the end of each visit, it would have been the task of the priestly class appointed and instructed by the space travelers to prepare the living dead again and preserve them once more in giant temples until the gods returned. Impossible? Ridiculous? It is mostly those people who feel that they are absolutely bound by the laws of nature who make the most stupid objections. Does not nature herself display brilliant examples of hibernation and reawakening? There are species of fish which, after being frozen stiff, thaw out at milder temperatures and swim around again in the water. Flowers, larvae, and grubs not only go into hibernation, but also reappear in the spring in lovely new garb. Let me be my own devil's advocate. Did the Egyptians learn the possibility of mummification from nature? If that were the case, there ought to have been a cult of butterflies or cockchafers, or at least a trace of such a cult. There is nothing of the kind. Underground tombs do contain gigantic sarcophagi with mummified animals, but given their climate, the Egyptians could not have copied hibernation from animals. 5 miles from Helwan lie more than 5,000 tombs of different sizes, which all date to the time of the first and second dynasties. These tombs show that the art of mummification is more than 6,000 years old. In 1953, Professor Emery discovered a large tomb in the archaic cemetery of North Saqqara that is attributed to a pharaoh of the first dynasty. Apart from the main tomb, there were 72 other tombs arranged in 3 rows in which lay the bodies of the servants who wanted to accompany their king in the New World. No trace of violence is visible on the bodies of the 64 young men and 8 young women. Why did these 72 allow themselves to be walled up and killed? Belief in a second life beyond the grave is the best known and also the simplest explanation of this phenomenon. In addition to gold and jewelry, the pharaoh was provided in the tomb with grain, oil, and spices, which were obviously intended as provisions for the life to come. Apart from grave robbers, the tombs were also opened by later pharaohs. In such cases, the pharaoh found the provisions in the tomb of his ancestor well preserved. In other words, the dead man had neither eaten them nor taken them into another world. And when the tomb was closed again, fresh supplies were placed in the vault, which was shut up, protected against thieves, and sealed with many traps. It seems obvious that the Egyptians believed in a reawakening in the distant future, not an immediate reawakening in the hereafter. In June 1954, also at Saqqara, a tomb was discovered that had not been robbed, for a chest containing jewels and gold lay in the burial chamber. The sarcophagus was closed with a sliding lid instead of a removable one. On June 9, Dr. Gonaim ceremonially opened the sarcophagus. It contained nothing, absolutely nothing. Did the mummy decamp, leaving its jewels behind? The Russian Rodenko discovered a grave, Kurgan V, 50 miles from the frontier of Outer Mongolia. This grave takes the form of a rocky hill that is faced internally with wood. All the burial chambers are packed with eternal ice, and as a result, the contents of the grave were preserved in a state of deep freeze. One of these chambers contained an embalmed man and a similarly treated woman. Both of them were provided with everything that they might have needed for a life to come, foodstuffs and dishes, clothes, jewels, and musical instruments. Everything was deep frozen and in an excellent state of preservation, including the naked mummies. In one burial chamber, scholars identified a rectangle containing four rows of six squares, each of which had a drawing inside it. The whole could be a copy of the stone carpet in the Assyrian palace at Nineveh. Strange sphinx-like figures with complicated horns on their heads and wings on their backs are clearly visible, and their posture shows them to be aspiring skyward. But motives for a second spiritual life can scarcely be based on the finds of Mongolia. The deep freezing used in the graves there, for that is what the chambers faced with wood and filled with ice amount to, is too much of this world, and obviously intended for terrestrial ends. Why, and this question keeps worrying us, did the ancients think that bodies prepared in this way achieved a state which would make reawakening possible? That is the puzzle for the time being. In the Chinese village of Wuchuan is a rectangular tomb measuring 45 by 39 feet. In it lie the skeletons of 17 men and 24 women. Here, too, none of the skeletons shows signs of a violent death. There are glacier tombs in the Andes, ice tombs in Siberia, group and individual graves in China, Sumeria, and Egypt. Mummies have been found in the far north and in South Africa, and all the dead were supplied with the necessities for a new life, and all the tombs were so planned and built that they could survive for thousands of years. Is it all mere coincidence? Are they all merely individual fancies, strange whims on the part of our ancestors? Or is there an ancient promise of corporeal return that is unknown to us? Who could have made it? Some 10,000-year-old tombs were excavated at Jericho, and a number of 8,000-year-old heads, modeled in plaster of Paris, were found. That, too, is astonishing, for ostensibly this people did not know the techniques of pottery making. In another part of Jericho, whole rows of round houses were discovered. The walls are curved inward at the top, like domes. The omnipotent carbon isotope C14, with the aid of which the age of organic substances can be determined, gives dates with a maximum of 10,400 years in this case. These scientifically determined dates agree fairly well with the dates which the Egyptian priests transmitted. They said that their priestly ancestors had discharged their duties for more than 11,000 years. Is this only a coincidence, too? Prehistoric stones at Lussac, France, form a particularly remarkable find. They show drawings of men dressed in completely modern style with hats, jackets, and short trousers. Abbé Bruel says that the drawings are authentic, and his statement throws the whole of prehistory into confusion. Who engraved the stones? Who has enough imagination to conceive of a caveman dressed in skins who drew figures from the 20th century on the walls? Some really magnificent Stone Age paintings were found in 1940 in the Lascaux Caves in the south of France. The paintings in this gallery are as lively and intact as if they had been done today, and two questions immediately spring to mind. How is this cave illuminated for the laborious work of the Stone Age artists? And why were the walls decorated with these astonishing paintings? Let the people who consider these questions stupid explain the contradictions. if the Stone Age cavemen were primitive and savage, they could not have produced the astounding paintings on the cave walls. But if the savages were capable of painting these pictures, why should they not also have been able to build huts as shelter? The foremost authorities concede that animals had the ability to build nests and shelters millions of years ago, but it obviously does not fit into the working hypothesis to concede Homo sapiens the same ability as long ago as that. In the Gobi Desert, deep down below the ruins of Karakota, not far from those strange sand vitrifications which can only have taken place under the influence of tremendous heat, Professor Kozlov found a tomb that is dated to about 12,000 years B.C. A sarcophagus contained the bodies of two rich men, and the sign of a circle bisected vertically was found on the sarcophagus. In the Subis Mountains, on the west coast of Borneo, a network of caves was found that had been hollowed out on a cathedral-like scale. Among these colossal finds, there are fabrics of such fineness and delicacy that with the best will in the world one cannot imagine savages making them. Questions, questions, questions. The first doubts are beginning to insinuate themselves into stereotyped archaeological theory, but what we need to do is to force breaches in the thicket of the past. Landmarks must be set up again. Wherever possible, a new series of fixed dates must be established. Let me make it clear that I am not doubting the history of the last 2,000 years here. I am speaking solely and exclusively of the most remote antiquity, of the blackest darkness of time, which I am striving to illuminate by asking new questions. Nor can I give any figures and dates showing when the visit of unknown intelligences from the universe began to influence our young intelligences. But I venture to doubt the current datings applied to the remote past. I would suggest, on tolerably good grounds, placing the incident I am concerned with in the early Paleolithic age, between 10,000 and 40,000 B.C. Our hitherto existing methods of dating, including C14, which makes everyone so happy, leave great gaps as soon as we have to deal with periods of fewer than 5,000 years. The older the substance to be examined, the more unreliable the radiocarbon method is. Even recognized scholars have told me that they consider the C14 method to be an out-and-out bluff, because if an organic substance is from 30,000 to 50,000 years old, its age can be established anywhere between those limits. These critical voices should be accepted only with limitations. Nevertheless, a second dating method parallel to the C14 method and based on the latest measuring apparatus would unquestionably be desirable.